track on the other side.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Jim Pennington of ALO's Books. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hiya. Hiya.
And we are ably assisted by Clive Graham of Paradigm Discs, who has introduced me to Jim Pennington of ALO's Books. And there is a connection between the two via the William Burroughs record, which we played a few weeks ago, Curse Go Back.
What are we listening to now?
I think this is a hippopotamus.
This is a hippopotamus.
This is a hippopo from North Senegal.
And, of course, this has absolutely no connection with William Burroughs whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
Except you are going to... It is apparently going to lead into some other...
Along the line, when I put it on earlier on today, the lady who made the record speaks in French, telling you what you're about to hear.
Right.
And then that's and then someone in English... translates what she just said, and then it zooms up again into the hippopotamus again. I don't know. I think we picked the track one from the wrong side.
I could easily flip it over whilst we talk amongst ourselves.
Let's talk amongst ourselves. Shall I flip it over?
Okay.
That's what record players are for.
In the meantime, I mean,
ask a question.
Well, how did you first meet Jim Pennington, Clive?
How did I meet Jim? I was putting some work through a printer that was downstairs from where Jim has his offices, just on Seven Sisters Road, which is literally just round the corner from where I live as well. And so there was a print job going on downstairs, and then Jim saw that and thought, that looks quite interesting. Because it was a 60s kind of hippie New York-based thing and called Rock and Other Four-Letter Words. And Jim picked up on the fact that it was also a book as well as a record, and he had the book, and so we then met one time, and just things kind of.
So when was this? How long ago was this?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah,
3 years, I think.
About three years ago.
Yeah, I see. And so at the time there was no link, but then you sort of you apparently spied or observed that Jim had some William Burroughs photographs.
That's right. There were some negatives that Jim had of these Hasselblad black and white negatives lying around in his studio. One was a reel of photos of William Burroughs. Another was of Geysin, taken by an English lady called Harriet Crowder. And
so how did you come to have these pictures, Jim?
I was a long time ago when ALO's was publishing frequently enough for people to think, I'll approach ALO's Books, see whether they're interested in publishing this. One guy that did that was someone called Melville Hardimont. And at that time, ALO's Books printed most of its material in the basement of the tube station, the Caledonian Road, where the charity War on Want was based, because War on Want had a printing unit there.
So anywhere near Housman's?
No, top end of
the other
top
end.
Top end, yeah. Okay. The other end of Cali Road.
Yeah.
And because he'd noticed ALO's Books, Caledonia Road, he got in touch and showed me a piece of material that he thought I might be interested in. He also brought in a magazine to get printed called Al-Bab, Issue 1, Number 1. About Arabic and Western culture meets, I think was the subtitle. And Melville was a bit of a, shall we say, he was a wheeler and dealer.
Right.
And I think he clearly got funding for this magazine. And from people in the...
Did you say when this was? I didn't catch it.
The mid-80s.
Okay.
Early 80s.
All right.
Early 80s. Uh-huh. And we did the magazine, and he kept pestering me about the piece of material he'd shown me, which was a long essay about Burroughs and about how the time he had been to Paris on a project for the BBC. He was a freelance then. And his project was expatriate writers in Paris.
Right.
And he was... He stayed at the Hotel Tournon. Tournon? Hotel Tournon. It's the classy end of Montparnasse, or Saint-Michel. And that was where he was meeting people like James Jones and Richard Wright and Chester Himes. And he also got to hear of Gilles Le Coeur, the Beat Hotel.
Yeah.
And was taken there. I've never found out who took them there, but they went there. Burroughs was not there at the time. Guyson was there. Sinclair Beales was there. Was there. And Corso was kicking around. And I'm ringing these names off because these are all... These were all photographed by the girl he was with, Harriet Crowder. That was her maiden name. Okay. They went on to marry a year or so later. And
Harriet Crowder married?
Melville Hardiman.
Right.
So, like 30 years later, just before the 2014 WSB 100, I was thinking, well, actually, you know, that piece which Melville showed me 30 years ago, I decided it wasn't quite something that we wanted to do at Allo's. But maybe now, I think I'll pin him, I'll find him. The first thing I found out was that he was dead. And then the next thing I found was Harriet's son had put a photograph of someone on Facebook. And because he'd bylined the photograph Harriet Hardiman, and it was a black and white photograph of an English lady from the mid-60s, I thought that lady's got to be the right kind of age, at least, with that Hardiman stuff. There were very few other Hardimans around. Managed to get through to her son, who said, and I said, I'd like to talk to your mum about Burroughs. He says, yeah, sure. He has her phone number, and I'm ringing her up.
Yeah.
And I said, I knew Melville, and I wanted to do something about Melville and Burroughs. And she said, oh, yeah, I've got a lot of photographs of Burroughs. Yeah? It was extraordinary. I went down the next day. She brings out a shoebox full of James Jones, Sinclair Beales, Guyson,
What format were they?
They were end prints, actually. The shoebox is full of end prints.
Prints, okay. Yeah. But were they shot on, 5.4 or 35mm or whatever?
2.5 by 2.5.
Okay, right.
Rolleiflex. And I think it was Rolleiflex, not Hasselblad.
Okay.
Rolleiflex.
Yeah, okay. And this was a box full of prints.
Mm-hmm.
And when had the pictures been taken?
61.
Really? 61. Wow. Okay.
60-61.
And never published?
Ah, well, you see this, one of them, the one of Burroughs, I said, I know that picture.
Ah.
And it took a while for it to suddenly twig that, in fact, it was the one that's used on the cover of Call Me Burroughs, the classic English bookshop, ESP.
Right.
First album.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And that's... it wasn't immediately recognisable because the photo I saw was from the waist up, whereas the Call Me Burroughs is just head. I don't know, you even see his shoulders, actually.
Right, right.
It's just a head and a hat.
So these pictures had sort of lain dormant for
They effectively lay dormant. When I said to her, by the way, did you know that photo was used on the iconic album? She said no.
Oh, my God.
Melville never told me what he did with them. and actually, that photo, particular photograph, was used consistently as publicity by Giraud Diaz, and it's appeared on a couple of French paperbacks.
Was she credited ever?
Never.
She was on the record, for
she
sure.
She was, actually, yeah, but they spelled it wrong. It was Crowther, T-H-E-R.
Oh, Crowther instead of Crowder.
It like that.
Okay. All right.
I can just hear some Frenchman saying, who took the photograph? Harriet Crowther.
Yeah. did she have a career as a photographer? I mean,
some photography. She not a, a long, long career, because eventually she had children very soon afterwards, and that tends to overtake any kind of career.
Right.
But she was taking photographs for quite a long time, and she ended up she went on to work as a radio X-ray photographer and medical photographer at Hammersmith Hammersmith Hospital until she retired about 15 years ago.
So what's happened then? How did you come to?
You've got to see more of these photos. You know. Her sons had done a very nice book of her photographs.
There is a book of her photographs published.
There is a book of her photographs, but it's a family thing. But I think they did 100 copies to family and friends.
Right.
And there's a nice range, because actually, her other photographs, taken at the same kind of period when she was. Melville was quite well known. He was a mover and shaker in the literary world in the 60s. He appears as the European editor of Outsider magazine, which you remember that one. Came out of New Orleans, Lujon Press.
Okay.
And they did 3 issues. They're much sought after now, and they carried the usual suspects. Bukowski.
I have to confess at this point that I'm something of a book dealer myself. I have dealt in poetry books, hence, which is why you assume I know about Outsider. And Clive, of course, did a whole program years ago of sound poets exposed. So we all have a kind of a link, a connection with
yeah, there's a lot of crossover,
poetry.
Isn't there?
Clive knew. My co-partner, co-founder of Allo's Books was Alan Fisher.
Right.
I've stayed at his house. Yeah.
What, in Hereford?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. Alan and I bump into.
He was in town quite recently.
He was. I couldn't get to it.
Nor did I, actually.
Who was the third partner then?
Dick Miller.
Dick Miller. Okay.
Who now makes bizarre sculptures out of large pieces of slate that he digs out from the Hudson River or wherever he can. He once took his pickup truck to one of those beaches north of New York, where on what's that island? What's the island? Bridgehampton and up that. What's that? Is that the island off New York?
Staten.
Is it Staten?
Long Island. Where?
Long Island.
Long Island.
The big long one. What's that called?
Long one.
The Long Island. It's called Long Island.
Okay.
He took his pickup truck to a beach there, which was big, which was big pebbles. It like bright and writ large, okay? And he's loading up these big stones that he was going to do things with. And somebody started shouting at him for taking the stones away. As if there weren't enough there are not enough stones on this beach. Nothing but stones.
Right.
Dick, nice guy.
So you and these and Alan Fisher and Dick Miller, you started up, I call it Allo's. Is it Allo's?
I call it Allo's.
You call it Allo's, A-L-O-E-S,
yeah.
Publishers.
Yeah.
Small press publishing,
small
what
press,
should we call
yeah,
it? I mean,
yeah.
Like poetry pamphlets and reprints and so on. I have come across them, mostly Thomas Pynchon, I think.
Yeah.
In the past. Thomas Pynchon, did you do one with Claude Pellier? Minutes to Go? Who was Minutes to Go?
Minutes to Go was Beach Books. We did some Pynchon. Because Pynchon had, Pynchon has this funny kind of publishing history, in as much as he doesn't publish very much.
Right.
And there were these short stories that had appeared in college magazines and in Saturday Evening Post, which are really quite good. And yet you could only access them by finding a back copy of the really obscure university magazine. I can't remember what it was called now. That one carried Mortality and Mercy in Vienna, which is a gem of a little story.
Yeah.
And so we did, I wrote to the publishers and got permissions for 3 of them, in sequence. And then something went wrong. I don't know. They never answered. We did the fourth one, Small Rain, which was a Saturday Evening Post. That one kind of went out without all the kind of boxes ticked and whatever. So we got a reputation for them for being pirate publishers.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is, you know, bloody unfair, really, given that we already published two Bob Dylan poetry books completely piratically. So I don't mind being a pirate if I'm going to do it piratically, completely kind of pirate-wise.
So these were known as what, bootleg publications?
Bootlegs, yes, that was the word, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, everyone was doing most of, that's really a record thing, isn't it? Yeah, bootleg records, and, yeah. Bootleg books is not quite the same.
How did you? I mean, you had no qualms about doing bootlegging publications.
It was different then, you know.
Okay.
There weren't people. I think in publishing, probably it was less of. It was something that was not. The copyright holders weren't knocking on your door the moment you even did anything.
But Dylan, printing, that must have been quite. You must have been stepping into.
They were just the sleeve notes off the back of a Joan Baez album. Uh-huh. 9 outlined epitaphs. Is it? Oh no, that's on the back of one of his albums.
Okay.
Poem to Joni was the one on the back of one of the first Joan Baez albums. A sweet little routine.
Yeah.
I don't think people were recognising him as a writer. Then
no.
Suddenly it appears that he is a writer, according to the
Nobel
Prize.
Yes, indeed.
Guys.
Yes, the Nobel Prize now, or whatever it is, for literature. So
they were done not to make money, but mainly to reformat them, actually.
Right.
Present them in a different way. It's this completely different thing reading Poem to Joni off the back of a sleeve as it is to reading it in a nice little pamphlet, beautifully printed and produced with interesting illustrations.
So
I've got one copy left.
Did you think you were kind of providing a service then?
We were definitely service providers.
By reformatting obscure material that was not available in any other way.
That's it. Your Honour.
Okay. Well, speaking of Your Honour, were you ever prosecuted for any of this? No.
We were asked to stop doing the Pynchon ones, which we did.
Okay.
Simple enough.
I found the story about the Patti Smith book. Was that in Compendium? Something about...
The Ha Ha Houdini one?
Yeah.
No. Yes.
Yeah,
That's not supposed to be told.
it's on the internet under some kind of website where it mentions, you speak well of Compendium books and Nick Kimberley, who I happen to know personally. And apparently there was a story of Patti Smith.
Yeah.
And there was a signed edition of something. And then she came to Compendium and noticed this pile of books, which...
I'll tell the story.
Okay.
Properly. Second time she was over here, and I was meeting her in Compendium to give her some money for when we published The Night completely, right. You know, straightforward. No written contracts, but you know,
yeah.
I sat with her in a cafe in New York, and she gave me the manuscript, and I said, when it's done, I'll give you some money. I can't remember how much, but whatever it was, we met up in Compendium. I said, is the check all right? And she hit the bloody roof. I don't want a check.
Right.
And Nick said, it's all right. It's all right, Jim. I'll open the till, you know, and you can write me a check.
Right.
So I ended up, it was a couple of £100, actually. It was not
at those times, it must have been quite a substantial amount.
She really needed cash, I think, Patti. Uh-huh. So, yeah. Because she wasn't writing checks for whatever she wanted to buy.
Right. Okay.
With cash.
Yeah.
And there was some... There was a pile of a bootleg edition of Ha Ha Houdini, which had just come out from Gotham Bookmark, which Compendium was importing, but it was like an enormous amount of money. And I think actually the first printing had been and gone, the Gotham Bookmark one.
Right.
So they were quite happy to take for someone to come in and give them 50 copies of Ha Ha Houdini.
Yeah.
And she saw that on the ground. She said, what's that doing there? She picked one up and said, oh, it's lovely. And then signed every one. And immediately Chris Render, who was the other bloke at Compendium, he kept taking them away as soon as she'd signed them.
Do you know,
I have never seen a copy of that book listed for sale with her signature on the front. I can't imagine what Chris did with them. They must have stashed them away to sell them.
Right.
It was Chris and the other bloke. Who was the guy? Nick. Nick Rochford.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, right, yes.
Paddy Gravel. that was funny, having Patti Smith shout at you. Ha Houdini. There was another... I tell you what can compromise Allo's book standing with respect to Pynchon. There was someone else who was doing something, editions of Pynchon, which were very clearly bootlegs, because they were totally anonymous publisher's name with no address. At least we put our address in them. Moldwarp and The Mind of Watts, too small, produced by Entropy Publication. No, there was Entropy and the Mind of Watts.
Did you single out Pynchon because he was because you thought these texts were valuable and hadn't been republished?
No, they were valuable. They hadn't been republished, and actually, they were incredibly well suited to a small little pamphlet format.
Right.
That's what made them nice to do, now come to think of it.
Yeah.
And the four we did of Pynchon's all are a different shape, and have a different style of cover. The first one was a duotone cover. The second one was four spot color, cartoony one. The third one was full color. Fourth one was full color with a larger B size format rather than A.
Right.
This is exceedingly tedious, telling you how to size the books are.
Book people be interested. The other side.
Yeah.
The side that we should have played originally,
happen there, hopefully, the lady who did the recordings in somewhere Senegal will tell us what she's talking about.
Richard Toll, au nord du Sénégal. Un delta avec des rizières et des étangs. Les grues couronnées traversent le ciel en longues files dans toutes les directions.
Richard Toll in the north of Senegal, a delta with rice fields and lakes. Lines of crowned cranes cross the sky in all directions.
La nuit tombe, les chacals commencent à hurler.
Manipulated. The basic Nova technique is very simple. Always create as many insoluble conflicts as possible and always aggravate existing conflicts. To create and aggravate the conflicts that lead to the explosion of a planet, that is to nova. Like this. Take two opposed pressure groups. Record the most violent and threatening statements of group one with regard to group two, and play back to group two. Record the answer and take it back to group one. Back and forth between opposed pressure groups. This process is known as feedback. You can see it operating in any barroom quarrel, in any quarrel for that matter. Manipulated on a global scale, feeds back nuclear war and Nova. These conflicts are deliberately created and aggravated by Nova criminals, the Nova mob. Sammy the Butcher, Green Tony, the Brown Artist, Jackie Blue Note, Limestone John, Izzy the Push, Hamburger Mary, Patty the Sting, the Subliminal Kid, the Blue Dinosaur, Willie the Rat, who had formed on his associates, and Mr. and Mrs. D, also known as Mr. Bradley, Mr. Martin, thought to be the leader of the mob. We intend to arrest these criminals and turn them over to the biologic department for the indicated alterations. Now you may well ask whether we can straighten out this mess to the satisfaction of any life forms involved, and my answer is this. Your Earth case must be processed by the biologic courts, admittedly in a deplorable condition at this time, no sooner set up than immediately corrupted, so that they convene every day in a different location like floating dice games, constantly swept away by stampeding forms, all idiotically glorifying their stupid ways of life, most of them quite unworkable, of course, attempting to seduce the judges into Venusian sex practices, drug the court officials, and intimidate the entire audience chamber with the threat of Nova. In all my experience as a police officer, I have never seen such total fear of the indicated alterations on any planet. A thankless job, you see, and we only do it so it won't have to be done someplace else under even more difficult circumstances.
And now, to give you the other side of the picture, William Burroughs reads from a yet untitled work in progress. Here, the Nova criminals are heard scheming to exploit planet Earth.
Okay, just to recap, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Jim Pennington of Allo's Books and Clive Graham of Paradigm Discs, and my phone bleeping in the background. And yeah. What's the connection between the hippopotamuses and the birds and William Burroughs?
It's just the incongruity of the French lady, the guy reading over that that bird song, and the incongruity of the guy, BBC guy with the received pronunciation, asking, "And now, Mr. Burroughs, what do you do next in Venus?" Oh, it's strange. I can't remember his name. I came across that CD. I can't remember how I came across it, but it is actually his very first BBC interview. Yeah. And it, not a lot of people know this, but the radio program that was first broadcast on the BBC, that was Eric Mottram, it sounds and looks like an interview that Eric Mottram conducted. But in fact, it was actually outtakes from that interview with Mottram into saying his bit. Mm. And then they took a bit of Burroughs and appropriate piece of the Burroughs recording, and you that as if the two were in the room almost, but they weren't. In fact, Eric had never met Burroughs until he came round to Duke Street, where we met him. We met up there when Allo's did the collection of Burroughs called White Subway, and before that, Eric had just corresponded with Burroughs. He'd never actually met him. And
so you published White Subway.
Yeah, it's a collection of small press pieces.
So are they reprints from gleaned from other sources, but had never been put together?
Never been put together before.
Okay,
we couldn't come up with it. We were wondering what to call it, and I did sort of said to William, "What should we call it? Should we call it an anthology?" And he said, "Never call anything an anthology."
Oh, really?
He's dead right, probably.
Right.
Kiss of death. Uh-huh. So he opened it up and read the first words, the white subway crawls out.
When was this?
72.
Okay. And so you met, did you meet him frequently or just?
Met him twice in England, and I met him two or three times over in New York.
Right.
New York and Boulder. I met him in Boulder. Uh-huh. I did one of those things when I was in New York. You got a car and drove it to the other side for someone else's benefit. But I was supposed to go in a straight line from New York to some place on the west, up near Vancouver. But I took these detours up to St. Paul and then down to Boulder. I think my mileage was double what it should have been. and Boulder was nice. Interesting. Just stayed overnight there.
Right.
Me and Max, I went over, primarily I went over there to see my mate Max Blagg, who had moved there and to New York. And he, we went over to his Franklin Street apartment, Burroughs's Franklin Street apartment.
Would this be an opportune moment to play some Max Blagg?
See what Max has got to say for himself halfway through that tape, which I haven't listened to for 20 years, because that's 1998, I think, that tape.
It all happened so fast. One minute you were sliding on grease lightning, moving right along, grinning blindly into the camera. Then suddenly you ground to a halt. You were ground up in tiny particles and laid along a mirror. And when the mirror was empty, you licked the snot from her nose. And then you drank her piss, pretending to impress her with your Aztec priest routines, but really to get high from the residue. Yes, you were a haiku man in those days. You liked it short and tight. And now, years later, you flip through your Kodachromes, trying to figure out which solemn beauty put her disease in you. It's too late to be pure. You're swaying slightly now and praying, a man on his knees in front of some terrible news, and you want to get a handle on it because you can't handle it. You never learned. You didn't try. You gave up on the second lesson. You weren't interested. You didn't care. You forgot about it, canned it, blinked and looked away, looked and moved on. You underestimated the shelf life of a sex maniac. And when things got tough, you whined and lay down like some sick barnyard animal. You're one skinned monkey and you stop no show. Your aura disappeared along with your memory down those raw, dawn streets. You couldn't even recall that her eyes were blue and how they moved you. You careened off the page, dead or drunk or both. The needle went right off the meter of your bullshit detector. You were totally bogus, defective in every way, and it's going to take more than simple faith to return from this sorry state. Your anti-damage systems are rusted out. The chrome is off your bumper, Jack.
I have to retrospectively apologise for any offensive words that appeared there. Yes, you.
I
might,
think we got off light.
Did I miss the offensive words?
Let's not go back.
I have to slap myself on the wrist.
I didn't.
I'm not going to repeat them, but there's at least two words there which are forbidden before midnight or something. So sorry to anyone if it's caused offence. So that was Max Blagg.
Yes, we did two books of his, 9 Years in the Wind Tunnel, illustrated by a guy called Ken Teaser, and another book called Licking the Fun Up. Licking the Fun Up. It was nice. That was a nice book.
Okay. So you travelled with him across America?
No, I went solo.
He was there?
He was just in New York.
And okay.
He's done that trip across New York and then back again. He tried to settle in L.A., but couldn't stand it. New York, I think, is really very English. New York, when it East Coast is very. The sentiments there, I think, are more conducive to a Yorkshireman.
Okay. All right.
What was I going to say about Max? That's it. Yeah, Max. Okay. He's got a book coming out soon.
Really?
Called Smoking. Called Smoking.
Okay.
Smoke Rings.
All right. Are you publishing it?
No, we're not. He's doing self-publishing.
You're still publishing under Allo's books?
Yeah, right? we've done a couple of things. I did a co-publication with a guy called Alexander Adams. Nice little duplicated Mimeo Gestetner product.
Oh, you're still doing it that way?
Never done one before like that. This is what's so intriguingly retro. I've always done litho. And then a few years ago, I kept seeing a Gestetner up on eBay, and I thought, that'd be fun. This was part of the project when I was looking for the Melville Hardiment thing, was to do a solely Mimeo Burroughs production. And I was looking at that Hardiment thing to do it that way. Yeah. And then I got into the idea of using Mimeo and the Gestetners and...
Yeah. So you had,
and I can now understand why everybody loved to do litho, because the Gestetner is a pain in the arse. It really is. And the next publication, of course, we're going to do. I'm doing just coming out soon, and that's the special edition of Curse Go Back.
Right. Well, this brings Clive in nicely. So this is Curse Go Back, issued by Paradigm Discs recently, and immediately sold out.
I sold a number of... Yeah, I did. I sold a lot of them, and I just repressed it. And so, yeah, Jim's got a handful that he's going to do a special edition of with bits and bobs and somewhat more explanation of what it's all about. Although it's fundamentally the same record, but there is a lot of objets that come with it.
Objets. Right.
Yeah.
Objet. Bits of tape and lots of print material. And, of course, a signed photo. Harriet, a signed photo by Harriet Crowder.
Signed by Harriet Crowder?
I'm afraid signed by Bill.
It's an edition of how many?
25.
Wow, it's a small edition.
It is.
That's
a big price. Small edition, big
yeah.
price.
Yeah, go on, how go much?
It's 100 quid. And okay. Look for it on the website.
So it's on the Allos...
Allosbooks.co.something.
Yeah.
Co.uk.
All right.
So you have a little...
Oh, you've got one with you?
Yeah.
Is this, okay. We can now examine the product.
It comes
yes,
with
very
a
nice. I see. So it's a what's this tape then? What is that? It's not a piece of
tape. That's a re-recording from Kersko back onto tape.
Right.
Then 22 inches taken off, cut up into pieces and then reassembled.
Yeah.
A couple of postcards, a packing slip which explains the contents.
And this, it almost looks like a 16mm film strip.
There is a strip of text, which is the actual Kersko back text transcript.
Is this film strip? Or?
That's a film strip. Yeah. It's just used as a header card so that you can fold it up. And the side of the perforations, I did one like that before. And there's another little inlay there of the...
Who's that?
And there's Ron, our man, L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh.
Who features surreptitiously throughout the whole of the text. That's a photo. That's a poster.
Which text? He features surreptitiously.
In Kersko back, which is a cut-up of a Scientology text.
Okay. So is this not some subliminal Scientologist sort of spell being cast by the record or something?
No, it's a William Burroughs spell being cast, not a Scientology spell.
So this
they don't do spells; they do curses. They do. What do they do to people?
So this little insert. Can I read this out, or are we going to get into trouble?
No, you're right.
There's a photograph of apparently L. Ron Hubbard, who I would not have recognised, with a sort of sailor. It looks almost like a Korean.
He was a sailor.
He was a sailor.
Yo ho ho and a bottle of.
Is he the one that sailed off with? With the wife of Jack Parsons.
There's a connection, isn't there? But I don't...
I think he did.
I think you
I
might...
Think he
I think
he swindled
I
Jack
think
Parsons
right.
out of a load of money.
Jack Parsons was
a rocket scientist, amongst other things.
An acquaintance of Alistair Crowley's.
And also in the OTO, whatever.
Yeah. And they did know one another.
Apparently, Jack Parsons' wife, I think, went off...
Yes, I think
Ron
you're right.
Hubbard,
I think you're right.
And a load of money. So perhaps that's how it all started. So anyway, this little pamphlet says, do what Ron says now.
Now.
Go to Scotland, get clear, go OT.
Operating Thetan. Don't ask me what an operating Thetan is, but apparently Thetans are important characters in the general cosmology of things.
I'm sure.
but the thing about that poster is that it's advertising the fact that they just opened a Scientology centre up in Edinburgh. And it was there that Burroughs went clear in 1968, which is what helps date this particular recording of Kersko back.
Right.
There's a book called Scientologist, which is about Burroughs' interest in Scientology. And in there it mentions that he sends Geisen this tape. It's a very chronological book, and it would indicate that it was 1968.
Right.
And the recording for the Kersko back LP was from Geisen's archive in Paris.
Right.
So and in actual fact, there's some very similar wording, like right at the very start of the record, Burroughs says, we learned about cut ups, and now we know what to cut up. And those words were used in this book, Scientologist, written by David S. Hume. Is it no
Wilkes? I think.
Anyway, and it's a book that just looks at Burroughs' connection to Scientology.
Uh-huh.
So that's another way of dating the tape.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's silly to say this, but it's so weird how things fall into place. But just last weekend, or just the other, about 10 days ago, I'm in a junk shop in Hornsey Road. And I'm looking in a cupboard. I saw a couple of Scientology books in amongst the dust. It's a really bad junk shop. I mean, a really good junk shop, but really badly looked after.
Sure. Junk.
Had that smell of I haven't had, this book has not been looked at for years.
Right.
A couple of Scientology books. I thought, that's strange. And then there was a sort of cupboard full of architectural plans. I thought, that's interesting. I opened up a folder, and the folder says, L. Ron's new house in St. Hill, East Grinstead. I thought, you what? Yeah. And it's full of planning applications this architect had done to develop St. Hill Manor, which Hubbard had just bought.
Yeah.
They're dated 63, these are.
Wow.
And there's there's Clivers in it. I've got a suitcase full of folders and architectural plans for St. Hill Manor and folders full of Scientology
worksheets,
briefing notes and bulletins. They're pretty, I mean, they're around. You can buy them off of eBay for a fiver.
Oh, okay.
But not a whole suitcase full. Yeah. And reading through them, every now and then you come, there are little phrases like that one, we now know what to cut up. There's a thing in one of the texts is we now know what to look at, we now know how to think. It's just that kind of cadence of some kind of logic in that those two phrases. We know we knew what to do, now we know how to do it, that kind of thing.
Right.
I think it's underestimated the small, funny little influences that Scientology had. Like, for instance, you just put 2 minutes of the Alice in Wonderland on, and it'll explain everything.
I must go back and see after some executions I have ordered.
The griffin sat up and rubbed its eyes. Then it watched the queen till she was out of sight.
Ah, what fun!
What is the fun?
Why, she! It's all her fancy, that, you know. They never execute nobody. Come on!
Everybody says, come on here. I never so ordered about before in all my life, never.
They had not gone far before they saw the Mock Turtle in the distance, sitting sad and lonely on a little ledge of rock. And as they came nearer, Alice could hear him sighing as if his heart would break.
What is his sorrow?
It's all his fancy, that. He hasn't got no sorrow, you know. Come on. This here young lady, she wants to know your history, so she does.
I'll tell it her. Sit down, both of you, and don't speak a word till I've finished.
I don't see how he can ever finish if he doesn't begin.
Once I was a real turtle. When we were little, we went to school in the sea. The master was an old turtle. We used to call him Tortoise.
Why did you call him Tortoise if he wasn't one?
We called him Tortoise because he taught us. Really, you are very dull.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself for asking such a simple question. Drive on, old fella. Don't be all day about it.
Yes. We went to school in the sea. Though you mean to believe it.
I never said I didn't.
You did.
Hold your tongue.
I only took the regular course.
What was that?
Reeling and writhing, a course to begin with. And then the different branches of arithmetic. Ambition, distraction, uglification, and derision.
I never heard of uglification. What is it?
Never heard of uglifying. You know what a beautify is, I suppose.
Well, that's a strange digression there. We've gone into Alice in Wonderland. This is with Joan Greenwood as Alice and Stanley Holloway as the narrator, and a fairly large cast. That was from the Griffin, I think. Do we have any connection between this and
other than the fact that one of the bulletins I was reading described in the Scientology routines that you take. You take a copy of Alice in Wonderland and you read a sentence at random to the person you are clearing, and there's a routine of saying, thank you, good, what do you think of this? And all the time the guy is holding an e-meter, and you take readings of how they respond to a random line from Alice in Wonderland. Now, okay. Do me a favour, if that is not pure inconsequential therapy, I don't know what it is. But it sounds great to me. I'd love it if someone started firing lines of Alice in Wonderland at me.
It's quite 60s as well, really, isn't it? Where was this happening? Was this in the UK or...
It's a worldwide franchise, and it was probably happening worldwide all at the same time, because these bulletins coming from St. Hill were actually worldwide bulletins. They would send them Australia, wherever those places were.
Right.
Yeah. Leonard Cohen was a Scientologist at one stage.
No way.
Yes, he was. He did a song called The Blue Curtain, the Blue Raincoat, Old Blue Raincoat.
Okay.
I've got it on there, only it's being played backwards.
Of course, we've all just heard the news that Leonard Cohen died presumably yesterday or last night.
Very recent.
So the link is that you say he was a Scientologist?
He mentioned Scientology in that song, The Blue Raincoat.
Right.
And I've got...
That's not evidence that he was...
No.
He was...
I've just read a book that insisted that Jean Cocteau was a Grand Master of the Priory of Sion.
Right.
And then I sort of read another book which said that the whole thing was a hoax and was actually planted in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And it influenced the Da Vinci Code and thousands of people. And so in the end, you don't know what to believe.
Well, there is clear reference to a Scientology thing in that song.
Okay.
I thought it would be nice to play a bit of what I've got.
I'm happy to play Leonard Cohen.
Play him.
We can...
Don't have to listen to it all, but let's have a couple of minutes of Leonard. It'll come on soon. It's quite quiet.
Is it?
Yeah. I can hear something.
It's quiet, yeah. Yeah.
That must be the most obscure Leonard Cohen track that we could possibly have played. It's deliberately.
I put it backwards because.
You put it backwards.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, you have me fooled.
It sounded quite nice.
It was really sweet, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'd have that played at my funeral. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, what is being played backwards then?
The something. I think it's old. Blue Raincoat. Oh, yes, Blue Raincoat. Can you say it backwards?
It's Raincoat Famous Blue.
Famous Blue Raincoat, yeah.
Famous Blue Raincoat.
I wrote the text.
Yes. And you've turned it backwards.
I turned it backwards.
Is that out of reverence for
Out of reverence,
Len,
just because I thought that a lot of this Kersko Back stuff is backwards. They're mucking about with music. But it's nice, though, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're not finding hidden meanings here.
Of course we are.
Okay. Well, I thought I'd end... We could possibly end with a yellow flexi disc by Peter Finch and Bob Cobbing on Second Eon.
Lovely.
Does that have any connection? You must have been around during the period of Second Eon and so on.
Yeah,
These must have been... All these English poetry publications and so on. Bob Cobbing. And
he did some lovely books and some lovely sounds.
Yeah. All right, let's have a snatch of this. It's a yellow flexi disc which came with a sort of a book of poems called Typewriter, which I think we might possibly have played once on Sound Poets Exposed many years ago.
When you came along as a guest?
Yeah.
Wow.
Does that ring a bell?
It doesn't, you know. So many of those shows, it's such a blur.
Yes, you were saying, Jim.
You would never have heard, if you went to a live performance of Cobbing or Peter Finch, you would never have heard it like this, because they didn't have the technology to do a live performance of distorted sound.
No, right. No,
well, this is the most you got was a megaphone, I think.
Oh, yes, Cobbing on the megaphone.
Yeah.
Peter Finch is playing a Jew's harp on this as well. Or is it called something else now?
No, well...
There's another expression there, for that
Which I've completely forgot, which is some strange reason.
Yeah,
so where was this recorded? Do you have any idea?
Oh, gosh.
Because, I mean, like Jim says, they don't really do much... They don't do studio stuff that much. And live electronics was quite rare with them as well, although there was a grouping called Oral Complex, which was live electronics...
Right.
Oh, okay.
With Lawrence Upton.
Upton, yeah.
Cobbing. And it was all organised by a guy called John Whiting, who recorded it, and he set up the sessions.
Yeah.
And he was quite involved with a group called Electric Phoenix, who were specifically kind of did live electronic vocal stuff, quite internationally famous for a short while. Hmm. And, works were commissioned for them, big time kind of stuff.
Well, this is 1973, and I've opened it up, and of course I've found the erratum slip.
Ah.
Which leads nicely to Jim Pennington and his collection of erratum slips.
Yes, I don't know why I started collecting them, but somehow you pick them. It's like you see a nice orange wrapper, and you see another nice one, and you keep them both.
Orange wrapper?
Orange wrappers, you know, those printed orange wrappers on tissue paper. I've got a collection of them as well.
How many erratum slips do you have?
I probably have about 100. Not all with the books that they came with. Some of the, I have to admit, the books have been slightly pulled apart just so I can get the erratum
bit. Just so you can get
them out. Yeah, the erratum slip and the bits that it's correcting.
Yeah. Are you the only collector in the world of erratum slips?
Do you know, I don't think I am.
No. I should imagine there's a society.
This world is large enough.
A secret society. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Can I just mention, with respect to the Leonard Cohen thing, I was introduced to Leonard Cohen by a bloke, not physically, but a poet called Bill Sherman, who lives in London now, and he wrote the sleeve notes to Leonard Cohen's first album.
Oh, wow.
I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah, yeah. That's good, isn't it?
And that's what made me think about working with he was the one that told me that track had something to do with Ron Hubbard. But that's what made me think to pick on a way of adjusting Leonard into the world, into the realm of magic.
Right.
Which he wouldn't have approved of, or maybe he would have approved of it, actually. Yeah. I think Leonard Cohen was probably a magician in his own way.
I don't know. He was a Buddhist as well, wasn't he?
As well.
As well.
So many
things.
Yeah.
I can hear these guys laughing in the background. Turn up the laughter.
Well, thanks very much to Jim Pennington of Aloes Books and Clive Graham of Paradigm Discs.
Oh, it's been great to do it. Great to listen in on this show live. It's quite a strange edition of Wavelength, if you ask
indeed,
me.
Indeed, good.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming in. This show repeats on Sunday at 9 o'clock in the morning.